But I don't know what episode number this is.
I don't remember either. This is the worst meme. This is the worst podcast this meme.
And it's not even a meme. Okay, here's a save. Here, I have a fidget spinner here. Can you hear that?
So you moved to Silicon Valley. You bought a fidget spinner.
I did not buy them. It came with the, like, employee orientation pack.
That's even worse, dude. That's so much worse. Is it branded?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Oh, my God. That's so bad. Okay, guys. This will be the last.
ASMR fidget spinner. ASMR.
This is episode 111.
Can you hear me? Have you ever watched any ASMR videos?
Sadly, I have.
This episode is going to be all ASMR.
Do I have to cooperate as well?
You can do what you want, man. It's a free world, free country. Okay, all right, stop.
So, in case you haven't noticed, Noyan is back.
Yeah, I'm alive. I didn't die. I didn't abandon the podcast.
I guess that's a good thing.
I mean, title is still going, so...
Yeah, we don't have a choice. Remember, we are bound by a hellish contract.
Yep, it's like a spell on our curse on our souls, and we cannot be released from this torment.
Anime cast is anime.
And dude, Cardi B just put out a Tidal exclusive documentary. Like, Tidal is not going to go anywhere anytime soon.
Oh God. Okay, I guess this is our lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Cardi. Never mind. I had some snarky comments about that, but it's irrelevant. So whatever. Okay. So how's it been, man? It's been a while.
It's been good. Yeah. I'm super tired as usual. But yeah, it's been good, I guess. Are you also devastated, or have you managed to settle in? Stop with the fucking fidget spinner.
I'm actually kind of jet lagged.
Yeah.
So because like it's a 3-hour difference for me, and like I just got my belongings like Friday evening. Today is Sunday, and like I haven't been able to kind of settle in yet. So before that happened, I would just, like, you know, we had this like inflatable bed that we're sleeping in with literally nothing else in the house.
Oh God.
So like I would just like get sleepy from boredom.
how's Riddick?
He's fine. He made the trip fine.
Not Vin Diesel's character. Yes, that's Noin's cat.
I have a cat named Riddick. Yes.
Yes.
It was fine. It was kind of traumatic, but
yeah, cats don't like changing environments.
Yeah, well, actually, he seems to like this new place better.
Oh, cool. That's nice.
Yeah, like the view is nicer. He just like we have these like giant windowsills that he can sit in front on and in front of and can watch outside.
Sweet.
Yeah, we have had a bit paid, of a health scare with him.
Oh, health scare? Why?
Yeah, so we took him to the vet, and it turns out that he has, like, a heart condition.
Oh.
Yeah. But thankfully, he was fine. Like, they gave us some sort of, like, tranquilizer for us to put him on the plane, and he just kind of chilled throughout the trip.
Oh, cool. Have you paid $20 for a cup of coffee yet?
No, I want to. I want to find where this $20 cup of coffee is. No, it's, like, $3 to $5, I guess, depending on what you're looking for. But, hey, at work, everything is free, so I don't care.
Yeah, it's called haciendas. I don't know if you're aware of that term.
No,
I'm joking. Not. I'm joking.
But the coffee here is very good. The food is very, like, everything on average is just so much better here, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, the West Coast is generally better than the rest of the country.
Which is the rest coast.
The rest coast. Oh, that's so good. Wow. Yeah, I just call it the hellscape.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I'm not in the part of California that has receded, you know. Have you heard that?
Receded?
A bunch of conservatives in, like, rural California have decided to, sorry, secede.
Secede from the union?
Yes. Yes. They're calling it New California, and they're making a new state. They seem to be pretty serious about it, but no one else is, so good luck with that, bro.
That went really well for them last time.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really good idea.
Those were fun times.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, so this podcast, what is this podcast about?
I don't even know. We had Simon the last episode, so I guess it's over now.
I mean, you kind of had Simon. You tried to have Simon.
Yeah, the tech issues were bad. I mean,
hey, man.
That's the problem of living in a country that, you know, they do every year they do that bet and they say, oh, winter won't be that hard. We won't invest in infrastructure and proper power grids and all that shit. And then it's true for most of the year, but you get like 4 weeks where it's quote unquote stormy, read raining, and it's like 10 mm-hmm. degrees Celsius, which is like what, 50, 60?
I don't know. 10 degrees Celsius makes more sense to me. Like,
yeah,
it's consistently like 10 to 15 here at San Francisco year round, by the way.
Yeah, I know. That sounds like the perfect weather. Although it gets really humid, doesn't it?
I think in the summer it might. I haven't been there yet.
Yeah. So, yeah. And we have all sorts of, heating bodies and stuff like that because all the houses here aren't insulated. So it's freezing inside. And then the power grid is like, nope, and fucks off. Music.
Oh, yeah, man. I haven't lived in Turkey for years, so the power grid just kind of fucking off thing, I've forgotten about that being
a
thing.
Yeah, that's a thing. That is a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, man. It feel bad.
I know. It sucks. In general, it sucks.
Baltimore had that thing about like how they would not prepare for the winter, and like the moment it snows, just shut down everything. Like just like a half a centimeter of snow, and it's like, okay, school's canceled, all the roads are dead. Like, how do we deal with this? No idea. Like, fucking dude, every year this happens. Just fucking, you know when it's gonna happen. Prepare the equipment and God.
Yeah, but Baltimore. Does that at least stop the murder?
I don't know.
Or is it just Baltimore and they kind of they pull food, they work food?
I think they just kind of like, you know, wrap the numbers in, like people die from like accidents in the snow. Right. And it's just people are dying, you know, it's a hellscape. Yeah.
It balances off. Cool.
Speaking of a hellscape where people die all the time.
Between the Buried and Me have a new single.
Yeah, because when people die, they go to the gallows, and this new song is called Condemned to the Gallows.
I was more like hinting how their career is now a hellscape of mediocre music.
Okay, here's how I feel about this album. You ready?
Yes. Jesus Christ. I should have seen that coming, but I didn't.
Okay. So actually, to be fair, like this single starts off pretty cool,
I think.
Like
I agree.
The first 2.5 minutes of it is really sweet, but then it kind of goes nowhere. Like it, at first I was more optimistic compared to like their previous album, Coma Inducing. I keep reading.
Ecliptic.
Yeah, I know. So there was some heavy stuff here. And screaming, and maybe there'll be something going on in the album. But then, like, they pad out the rest of the song with kind of just nothing prog riffs with the occasional Between the Buried and Me-ism to kind of distract you from the fact that not much is going on. Which is a shame, because, like, I feel like if this song was, you know, half the length, then it would be pretty cool, I think. But it's just that it feels like they're trying to just drag it out.
I mean, I agree with you. It just felt very, way, way, way too long. I just want to add two things. One, Tommy, please stop screaming. Please just, dude, you're not good at it. You never will. It's fine. It's not your thing.
He's not getting better at it either. Like, I'm not trying to shit on the guy, but like, you know, over years, just, you know, takes its toll on your voice, and it's okay if you stop or like tone it down.
Yeah. And, I love his solo work just because he feels more comfortable in the vocal role though. I love his timbre. Like his voice is really unique and weird. There's something mm-hmm. about it that is very non-traditional.
And in this song, it's like a few points. He does this weird thing, like as a backing vocal track, there's like really high, like, type vocals going on in the background. Like it's very subtle. But if they kind of double down on that more avant-garde-ish type of voice thing, then maybe like he could expand.
And the second thing I want to say is we shouldn't really be surprised that they're just doing their thing because everybody is eating it up. Like, there seems to be no sense of self-critique with this band. It's amazing. Every single thing they release gets the same titles and the same rave reviews. Like,
mm-hmm.
fans of this band. I mean, I'm not going to tell you if it's good or not, but you can't, it's baffling to me that someone thinks this is on par with The Great Misdirect or Colors or even Pre-Colors work, or even, I'm going to say, even Parallax, which I didn't really like. But it just seems to me it doesn't matter what Between the Buried and Me do, as long as it's long and it has those, BTBAM isms, right? The unique shtick, then, you know, people will just eat it up. And like the title of, hey, Greg, by the way, Greg Kenelty, he wrote the Metal Injection article. And the title is like, Between the Buried and Me's new song, Condemned to the Gallows, is so good. Like, what kind of reporting is that? Like, I mean, if the title says that, then what value does the post have? Like, it doesn't even say, why is it good? Like, why is this track worthwhile? And I think that if you'd have like more scrutiny and more self-critique, you would say stuff like, I really like this track, but it has issues. And how will this work in the album? And blah, blah, blah. But instead it's just, oh, this is so good. Blah, blah, blah. And in the related posts, Between the Buried and Me is the Coma Machine music video is 9 minutes of prog bliss. Could you stop, like, I'm sorry for being, you know, rude.
It's interesting because, like...
Wait, let me be rude if I apologize for it. Sure. I'm sorry for being rude, but, like, can you stop jerking this band off? Like, it's so off-putting to me.
It's funny because, like, in a lot of other forms of media, negativity gets a lot more clicks. Like, if you... post a negative opinion, it's going to get a lot more attention. So it's interesting that that the metal scene is kind of just proceeding with this way anyway. And I mean, like, there's two ends of the spectrum in terms of, like, you know, we could be there could be the really shitty super elitist hates everything kind of metal journalism site like us. No, I'm kidding. like, you know, those shithole sites that just hate every band that came out after like 1984 or something like that. No, but, like, you know, a more critical take on something could be interesting. But we see that the fan base doesn't react that way either. Like, it generally seems that in metal, in the internet metal nerd scene at least, it seems that there's, like, this trend of, you know, as long as a big name band is doing something relatively acceptable with good production, then that's good enough.
Yeah, it's gonna be the most amazing thing. And related to the single, there's also some interesting news. They're going on tour between the Bird and Me with Leprous and the Deer Hunter, which is kind of cool. And also, if you buy a VIP ticket for this tour, you will get an exclusive 7-inch release, which is Between the Buried and Me covering the Deer Hunter and the Deer Hunter covering Between the Buried and Me.
And I'm more interested in the latter, honestly.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Between the Buried and Me covering the Deer Hunter, I think the Deer Hunter are much better musicians. So I don't really, not really excited for that. But the Deer Hunter covering Between the Buried and Me is really interesting because there's also, I feel like, a larger genre shift in that direction, from the Deer Hunter to Between the Buried and Me. Mm-hmm. And they, like a heavy band, a heavy-ish band doing like a lighter band songs, whatever, but like a lighter band doing a heavier band's songs is always more interesting to me. So,
yeah, I'd be interested in seeing if they like cop out and do like a few like lighter songs by Between the Buried and Me, or they just go full on and like...
They should do Swim to the Moon.
They should do Misdirection. Sorry, not Misdirection. The long song on that one. Obfuscation, sorry.
Yeah.
Obfuscation, right? That's the name of the song.
That's the first one.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Between the Buried and Me, it is what it is.
And also, by the way, this album is going to be two albums for no reason.
Yeah, it's going to be too long. It's going to be filled with, you know...
No. It's like, they're releasing one album's length worth of material in two EPs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds like a Sumerian thing.
Yeah, so now they're signed to Sumerian, by the way, and yeah, this is a very Sumerian thing.
Yeah.
And, well, yeah, whatever. Like, I mean, to be fair, I think there's still a chance for this to be good, and I'm sure it will be better than Coma Ecliptic, regardless.
Yeah, that album was just bad.
But, yeah, we'll see, I guess. You know, I haven't, like, completely written them off. It's not, like, a very strong start for them, but...
Yeah.
Who knows? Like, I still listen to the song a bunch of times, and I feel like if they step it up from here, then there's potential here. But probably not, so I'm not, like, keeping my hopes up.
Speaking of mediocre progressive metal, There's a new Cynic there, track.
Oh, there's so much we could go here. Yeah. There's a new Cynic song. Okay. So we remember the shenanigans that went on with Cynic like about over a year ago, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where Paul Masvidal essentially went full on diva and kicked out Sean Reiner, which was like the other 50% of the band. And then there was like this big legal dispute about who owns the name. And in the end, Sean Reiner seems to have conceded and Paul still owns the Cynic name. And Sean Malone, he's not a stakeholder, but he's, you know, a pretty important name in the Cynic. Like, he's not a legal stakeholder, but he's like a big part of Cynic. So Sean Malone kind of stayed with Paul. And now they have a new song up. It's called Humanoid. And it's okay.
It's like, better than Kindly Bent to Free Us.
Yes.
Which was just embarrassingly bad.
Yeah, so it seems like this feels like a song that should have come out after Traced in Air.
Yeah, definitely. It has that signature Cynic Traced in Air sound and vibe to it. You know, that riff.
Yes.
Although the vocoder is missing.
Yeah, so there's either no or very light vocoder on Paul's vocals, and it only goes to show that he's not that good of a singer. Like, I mean, he's okay, but he can't really carry the same way, and also he's trying melodies that normally with vocoder it would be fine for him to attempt, and like the vocoder just kind of makes it weird. But here it's kind of like it just doesn't work with a more normal voice, and it also doesn't fit the sound as much either.
So there are projects out there that were contemporary with the Cynic releases. What's it called? Aeon Spoke, mm-hmm. where he doesn't use the vocoder, and he sounds fine there. He sounds better than this. I just feel like he's kind of like Tommy, by the way. He's constantly pushed to the edge of his ability by this style that he, for some reason, made his own. And he can't really put it off. So it doesn't sound natural. It sounds forced. Like, he's constantly on edge. And a lot of what we equate with good singing has to do with comfort, right? Has to do with someone that feels like they're singing within their range. That's something that translates to listeners as good singers. And when you constantly push yourself, then you don't sound right. It sounds bad. And this is very much the case here. Like you said, the track is okay. But like, this used to be one of the best bands on the fucking planet.
Yeah.
This used to be, even if you didn't like Traced in Air as much as you did Focus, mm-hmm. then I like them both to an equal degree. Traced in Air is still an amazing album, even those who don't think it's as good as Focus.
Yeah,
this
sure.
used to be like a trendsetter band. And right now it feels like they're chasing their own name and their own shadow.
Yeah.
And the drama doesn't help, obviously, right?
Yeah. And also a few other things around this track. So it's on Season of Mist now, interestingly. Yeah. They have a new drummer, obviously, and it's produced by Nolly, and the drums are super loud in the mix.
Too loud.
I feel like the best thing in this track is the bass.
Yeah, the bass is great, but Sean Malone is, you know, he's
Sean Malone just doing his own thing. Like, he doesn't care about the controversy. I mean, he obviously cares, but like, you know, he still does his thing and he still has like more to say musically. I feel like he's the one in the band who still has the most going on.
Yeah, to contribute maybe to something new instead of just rehashing stuff that he used to do.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily that it's like groundbreaking bass. It's very much in keeping with the style and the genre, but it feels more like, okay, I'm a musician and I'm going to perform this to my full capability rather than just templating.
Mm-hmm. And also,
go ahead.
So in 93, Focus was like super ahead of its time. And in 2008, Traced in Air was pretty ahead of its time. But at this point, this is literally just feels like a Traced in Air B-side and it doesn't feel ahead of its time anymore.
Yeah, when you have bands that have already carried the torch forward, like Serge and... what's that other instrumental? Sutra?
Exivius, Our Oceans, like the Cynic offshoots. There's Sutra, yeah. And yeah, I mean, there's the whole tech death scene kind of Obscura, really a
Persephone, kind of?
Yeah. I feel like at this point, they lost their kind of capital that they had with their kind of originality. And we don't even know if this is leading to a new album. Probably, but it's only announced as a single so far.
Yeah, which is also kind of weird for a band that they're at the pointer at their career. Like, just save the single until you have something substantial. Although I guess they kind of want to say, hey, we're still alive. Here's music. We're working on stuff behind the scenes, especially with the drama. I didn't know they were even a band before this.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Last we heard, they put out some old B-sides and whatnot, if I remember correctly, despite Sean not wanting to, or something like that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, something.
Speaking of Obscura.
Obscura, yay.
I set that segue up and then completely botched it, but okay. So Obscura are working on a new album. They've apparently completed it. Let's see if they can keep their lineup before they release this one. So this album is going to be their fifth. It's going to be titled Diluvium, mm-hmm. Which kind of goes along with the kind of names they've used for the albums in the past.
Yeah.
It's still produced by Vic Centura, who's produced pretty much all of their albums, except I'm not sure if he produced the first one, but everything else. Coming out this summer on Relapse. There's the bassist Linus Klausenitzer's father is Professor Ulf Klausenitzer. Apparently he's a violinist and a conductor, and he plays he has some orchestral contributions to the album. One of the founding members of the band is coming back on cello. From the band's debut album, he played cello and drums. That's all the info we have right now. And
yeah,
I'll
take, you know, the more objective stance here, because you're a huge fan of this band.
And also I have, at this point, personal involvement almost.
Yes, I was going to say, you have connections, artistic connections and business connections even with Tom Gelschlager. And I'll say that for me, from the sidelines, I liked the previous album and I like everything
else. Yeah, I like all of their albums.
Yeah. The question is, now that Tom isn't in the band, can they meet or exceed their work on their previous album, which I feel was, correct me if I'm wrong, their most technically ambitious?
So let me put it this way. Omnivium was their most ambitious album technically in terms of sheer shred potential.
Mm-hmm.
Acrosis was their album that was just progressively and technically, it wasn't as shreddy. It was slightly slower, but Tom's solos were totally off the charts, and also, it was a lot weirder and more creative.
Yeah, that's why I think it's my favorite release by them. And now the question is, what next? So Tom is no longer a part of the project, and this project has notorious reputation for being able to keep its members around. So, and they're all still very talented musicians. Obviously, mm-hmm. They set the bar for talent almost in their respective fields. So what's next? How is this album going to sound? Which approach? Will they go back to shred? Will they try to recreate that sort of weird progginess? It's very interesting. So this is a big bookmark in the year for us. We're very much expectant of this release.
So as a super fan, they're probably one of my favorite bands still, despite all that has transpired. And so I think there is a through line throughout their albums that is the sound of Stefan. Stefan is the founding member of the band.
Yeah.
Throughout the years, Cosmogenesis had a big influence by Christian Musner and Hannes Grossmann and Jaron Paul Thessaling, and so did Omnivium. And then when they left, it was kind of a core Stefanism sound with an amazing flavor of Tom on top of it on Acrosis. And I feel like if not for Tom, it maybe wouldn't have stood up as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just the sound. Because I feel like Stefan's core sound is cool. It's unique and I would listen to it. But it's not enough in this day and age in the genre that they're in, I feel. So I think that he needs someone else to keep spicing things up. And the only new member in the band is the guitar player Rafael Trujillo, I think. Even though he's German, he has, so I don't know what kind of player this guy is. I don't know much about him. Obviously, he got dropped in really big shoes to fill. And he's done his best to do so. But I don't know what he does as a composer. The fact that they're bringing in Linus Klausenitzer's father, who is a classical composer, into the fold, maybe speaks to me that that's kind of how they might be trying to
shift things up,
bridge the gap, I was going to say.
Oh, okay.
Because like the song that was pretty much the most interesting on the last album was Weltseal, the song that Tom wrote, which is like the 15 minute weird ass long crazy prog thing and had like symphonic elements. So maybe they're trying to kind of follow along those directions, and maybe the new lineup has like settled into place enough that they can have something to say. But like you said, it's like, if you look at from the outside, if you don't really follow the news, like this is a band that has had like an amazing track record with like stellar album after stellar album. But actually, this album is at a place where it's very contentious, in my opinion, as to whether they will be able to kind of recapture that.
Yeah, it's an interesting story to be sure. Like a band that has always been unstable and yet has been somehow able to release consistently amazing albums. And it kind of, if you're not a journalist or a fan that digs behind the scenes, then you would have gotten a very different story than the story that we have, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Oftentimes, instability in lineup leads to shoddy musical output. But here, just the rotation has been so consistent in maintaining talent that it kind of the music belies the situation behind it.
So I gotta say, like I interviewed Stefan for the podcast a couple of years ago, and it was like probably my favorite episode that I did. It was really cool. We totally nerded out, and he has like vision for the project. He has the passion, and you know, regardless of what he might be as a personality, like I think he's really dedicated to the project, and he puts a lot of thought into it. And
I mean, you can accuse none of them of being lazy. Very hardworking individuals.
And one thing is that I think is very undersold is the producer, Vic Santura. Because from what I understand, you know, I'm not going to say too much, but from what I understand, he has a huge influence on how this turns out.
Interesting.
Like, his touch really kind of keeps things together from what I understand. So that they've been working together for a long time. I think he is like the secret member of Obscura that's super underrated.
Yeah, I mean, producers are often, that's the case, right?
Yeah.
Man, this guy's discography is just insane.
Vic Santura?
Yes, holy shit.
I mean, he's in Triptychon. He was in Non-Euclid, which is Morian's band, Morian of Alkaloid, and also Dark Fortress, which is also Morian's band.
Yeah, but also like he produced Shamash, Secrets of the Moon, Pestilence,
Hannes Grossman.
Hannes Grossman. Holy shit, like so much stuff on here. Dark Fortress, obviously. Krom as well.
Great Celtic band. Frost.
Celtic Frost. Holy shit. This is like a who and whose list. Alkaloid. Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I think very evil sounding albums, right? Like sinister.
And all very good sounding albums.
Yes, for sure. Oh, he produced Winter Horde. That's an Israeli band. They're pretty good. He also worked on The Ruins of Beverast's latest album, Exuvia.
Oh, nice.
From last year. It also sounded really good.
Yeah, and like he always brings like a really, like there's a really consistent Obscura sound, and he is a big part of that. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Speaking of bands that are not consistent with their sound, unfortunately.
God, please, no.
There is a new Machine Head.
What the fuck? No, wait, I just want to say this. What the fuck did I just hear? I've listened, unfortunately, to this track like 5 times since they released it, because I couldn't bring myself to come to terms with it. Okay, now you can do the thing.
Okay, yeah, I love Machine Head.
I also love Machine Head. They're a great band, but oh god.
The Blackening is in like consistently top 5, if not top 10 album for me
and
of all
Through
time.
The Ashes of Empires.
Yeah.
Great band.
Yeah, so I feel like, you know, infamously, they started off pretty good, had this weird new metal streak that everybody hates, and then they came back with Through the Ashes of Empires, and they had 4 amazing albums of, like, Through the Ashes, The Blackening, onto the Locust and Bloodstone and Diamonds. And now, I don't know what the fuck is going on. And I'm not even going to go into, like, Rob Flynn's public meltdowns about the reception to the album. But, like, this album, we have the promo. And, like, I really tried to like it. But I feel about the album how I feel about this video. Go watch this video, and then, like, that's how the album feels.
And just, like, okay, a few things.
The song is Kaleidoscope, by the way.
Yes. Okay. So who produced this video? They should be banned. Take away their editing software. Like, I don't know how, go to the UN, like, a resolution that they're not allowed to film anything else ever again in their life. That's one. Two, why does Rob sound like he's constantly out of breath? He just sounds like he ran a jog and then recorded vocals for this track. It's absurd. Is that on purpose? Is that like an affectation?
I don't know. He does the like breathing into the mic sometimes, like between verses, like, but usually it makes it sound like intense. But here, it, like you said, it just sounds
and
not great.
The track, like a few times, is almost "I did my time" from the Slipknot track,
Korn.
But it never. Korn. Yeah, exactly. Right. So it never quite does that, and it's so irritating. I keep expecting the Slipknot track to start, and it's just Kaleidoscope instead.
The album. The album has so many like B tier Slipknot moments. Like, it's a lot of songs on it are just like, man, I don't know where to begin with this fucking album. Like, I'm so mad about this. Like, okay, I don't want to sound like those asshole reviewers who are like shitting on this album, but it's just fucking bad. Like, I don't want to be agreeing with these people, but like, what the fuck is going on here? It's like a cross between like Slipknot, not even B-side, like Slipknot Z-sides, Machine Head's new metal era, and like the latest Suicide Silence album. Like, so what the fuck is going on here? Like, what happened?
The last thing I want to say about this track, and you know, Machine Head have always had like cheesy lyrics.
Yeah.
It's kind of been the thing, but they used to work, right? You know, the all-time famous moment of the Vidian, you know, Let Shotgun Ring and all that stuff. It's super cheesy and dumb, but it's fun. And here it's like, wave your metal fingers in the air.
Yeah.
And literally the second verse opens with "open a fucking pit." What the fuck is wrong with you? Those are not lyrics. That's stage banter. What the hell are you doing?
Normally those cheesy lyrics work because the rest of the music packs such a punch that it's just like, you just roll with it, right? You just keep, but here it's just like, the music is not that good. Like, it's like just generic groove metal, and there's no like energy to it. So it's just like the lyrics just come off as like super cheesy.
By the way, an interesting thing. It's kind of hurting them. If you look at the views, Catharsis, which was released at the beginning of December, so it's had more time. Mm-hmm. It has over 1 million views. Mm-hmm. And then Bastards has 220, and that was released January 11th, so it's kind of recent, but still. And then this one has 134. So I don't know whether it was the reviews or just the tracks being not that good, but it doesn't seem to be going over well. By the way, Bastards is also like so cringy, even if I agree with the ideas.
Yeah,
just the soapbox nature of it is just
Have you seen the slam poetry version of Bastards?
Okay, it's been open as a tab for ever since I first saw it, and I can't bring myself to press play.
I feel like Rob Flynn has like lost his mind after Phil Anselmo outed himself as a Nazi. Like, Rob Flynn just broke.
Maybe it's like, you know, we can go back to the anime motif. Maybe they're like dark reflections of each other. And when one falls, so does the other, and they kind of need themselves, you know, each other to feed off their energies. I don't know.
I don't know, man. Like, what the fuck?
Wait. What if Rob's stand is Phil Anselmo?
Hey, man. Don't talk about things you don't know about. If we want to go into JoJo, we're going
to
be...
I've read enough about JoJo to talk about it, and it's on my list. I will watch it one day.
Yeah, right. Okay. Let us turn things around a bit more. There's this... Speaking of things burning down, there's this one thing that I just added to the agenda. I don't know if you got a chance to see, but so this has been in the working.
This segue is terrible. Now I get it.
Yeah,
speaking of things burning down. Jesus.
this has been in the works for a while, but they're making a Lords of Chaos movie. So if you're unfamiliar with it, Lords of Chaos is the book that chronicles the rise of black metal and like all the stuff that happened in Norway, essentially. And it's like a, it's kind of like a documentary, like in nature, but like in the sense that it's kind of like Making a Murderer in that, like, it's not dry, right? It's kind of like a interesting documentary read, and it has interviews with all the people involved and whatnot. Well, the ones that are still alive and like not in prison. So they're making a movie out of it, and the poster looks amazing, and it's made by Jonas Åkerlund, who usually does music videos, but he's also done a few movies as well. The movies were not very well received, but he's done really good music videos. And this could be very bad, but it could also be amazing. And I'm really looking forward to it. I really want this to be good because I love the book.
Yeah, this could be terrible. Especially that poster. It is amazing graphically. But if like if this movie glorifies for even a second church burning, I will walk the fuck out on it because I cannot stand that. And I'm sorry for using this word, I never use it in this tone, this millennial worship of church burning. It's become cool now, and all these black post-black bands and black metal bands from the East Coast usually toting around shirts with church burning on it, fuck that shit. And if this movie, like, for a second glorifies that, like, in an uncritical way, that will suck. And this guy, by the way, Jonas, was in Bathory, by the way.
Yeah. So he's familiar with the situation. And the book is not glorifying at all.
Yeah, the book isn't at all. I like the book. But if this takes that spin to it.
So,
another trivium about this. Ah, trivium, get it? Sigur Rós is doing the soundtrack.
Interesting choice.
That's such a weird choice. Like, the post-rock bands to end all post-rock bands, not even post-rock, like post-pop, whatever, weird-ass Scandinavian minimalist band doing the soundtrack for a black metal movie.
I feel like Ulver would have been a great choice.
Yeah, I kind of think they don't want anything to do with these guys.
Yeah, Ulver probably was like, that page of our lives, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I was never, I'd never made an album about the forest. That wasn't me.
I never burned the church. Yeah, so I think for this movie to work, I envision it as like a tone-wise, The Witch.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Witch?
Yes, I have.
Okay, yeah, something like that, like really unsettling, almost horror movie-like, very like somber tone. If it's like, oh yeah, black metal is cool, then no.
Yep. This has a very high disaster potential.
Yeah. Jonas Åkerlund could totally be a disaster artist.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay, go ahead with what you want to talk about.
So wait, there's good new music, not just bad stuff. Arkona.
Yes, hell it came out this Friday, I believe.
This album is so good. It's exactly what I wanted it to do. It has better production than the previous albums. It kind of erased the one problem I had with this band. But it's still, and again, a word I don't like using, but I'll use it here because it fits. It's so authentic, right? It's so unrelenting. The way they use the Russian in the outro and the intro, like they use the really guttural R's and those kind of sounds to create this eerie vibe. The length of the tracks, you know, 17 minutes, 12 minutes, really long tracks, so dense. Lots of death metal ideas, but also that really unique blend of folk that they have. Incredible. It's just an incredible album. I can't believe they did it again. You know, this is one of the most underrated bands in metal, I feel.
So underrated. And like, if you like the kind of folky type of black metal that comes out in droves out of Norway, but if you're kind of sick of that sound, give this one a try because it's like a totally fresh take on that similar kind of idea.
And it's kind of amazing that, didn't they release an album in 2016?
Yep.
In November. So this is super fast for such a huge album. Oh no, but that was a re-release.
Oh yeah, you're right. It was a redoing of their earlier album. So their latest real album was
2014.
Yav, 2014. I don't remember if the Varazdini release was like re-recorded or just remastered. I'm not sure.
Something
anyway.
Along those lines.
Whatever. Okay. So actually, I just wanted to say, like, you know, we discussed in the end of year podcast about how I was like not impressed with the kind of music of last year too much. I mean, this year already there's so much good stuff out that I'm listening to, like the Arcona album, Howling Sycamore, which I know you didn't love, but I think it's pretty cool.
I actually did fucking love that album. It's just as I wrote in my review, it gets kind of muddy along the middle. But when you listen to tracks instead of the album at full length, it's mind blowing, and the album at full length is still very, very, very good. It just loses steam towards the middle.
Yeah, and the still kind of unannounced upcoming Rivers of Nile album.
It's so good, so good, and we are not fans. I mean, if you've listened to this podcast, you know that we weren't huge fans of Monarchy.
Yeah.
And Seeds of what? What
was I actually love Seed of Light, but not like this level love.
It's also a good album, but we have a lot of problems with it and criticisms, especially the production. And here it kind of feels like it was you that said that they either have good albums with bad production or bad albums with great production.
I think it was Simon.
Yeah, so I agree with that. Monarchy was well produced, but it was not an interesting album. And this has both, and it's also weird.
Yeah.
As fuck.
It's like them basically them kind of doing the next step in the Fallujah game.
Yeah, for sure. It has these like psych rock influences.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. I didn't expect to like it this much, but I kind of love it.
Yeah, so point is that Arcona is yet another one of like super solid. I was not very impressed with last year's black metal, but this year, yeah, it seems like going to be more my kind of year, which I'm happy.
Speaking of black metal, there's a new Zeelin Ardor track. So for those of you... Yeah, for those of you who don't remember, Zeelin Ardor is a project melding gospel music, American gospel music, and black metal. And it spawned from a racist comment saying that you could never meld the dirty N-word music and the pure white music of black metal.
And actually, from what I remember, it's like from a 4chan challenge. 4chan. Yeah.
So... And then someone picked up the glove and made Zeelin Ardor. And the first album was good, but it had its problems.
First album was good, and then it was good again because they took it down and re-released it.
And all the journalists were like, oh, wait, we can look cool by putting this album in our list. And they did.
You know what's funny? I saw this in the agenda, I didn't listen to it because I thought it was like... an old item left there, and like it was like a re-release, so I was like, what? Never mind.
So no, it's Baphomet, released as part of Adult Swim's singles of 2017, but it was just released 4 days ago, so whatever. it's really good. It's so much better than the album, I feel. It has
Swim singles is killing it. Like, they had Mirkor.
Yeah, they have really good stuff. They did the research. So this sounds a lot more cohesive than the album. So it doesn't kind of have black metal along the track, but then the outro is, I think it's the best thing they've written so far, or at least the best thing we've heard from them so far.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what this is, just go and listen to it. There's really no way to describe it.
Yeah.
It's super cool. I love this track. I hope this is from an upcoming album, maybe released this year, and that's it.
So if you... check them out, their live performances. It's actually really cool and gives me more hope for the future of the band.
Yeah.
So hopefully they can capitalize
on that. It's kind of become a band and not just a passion project, right?
Yeah.
Not just one guy doing something with mixing software. It's an actual band.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, last new music thing. Aviations. Mm-hmm. So Aviations are a band that I hate to love. And why is that? Because they've released like a single every 2 years for the last 8 years or something like that. And they've all been amazing. And they've all been amazing in this really special way, because they're part of a genre which I usually can't stand, which is the try-hard fusion prog. Think RNL. Remember those videos with Jordan Rudess and like 50 people on the screen playing the xylophone or something?
Yeah.
It's usually super cloying. I'm sorry if I'm annoying anyone, Berkeley graduates who are more about, look at all these instruments I can play. Here's Jordan Rudess, the guy who ruined Dream Theater. sorry. So, and then they actually released an album, this album that we've been promised for so long. They had all sorts of problems with the vocalist leaving and coming back. It was really unclear what was happening. And the album is so fucking good. It's amazing. It's the same kind of formula that was on the singles. Good ass fusion prog that's more about feeling and charm than it is about technicality. They have these really cool interludes all through the album, which really aren't fusion. So there's like, at some point, it's kind of like a jazz piano that gives you a vibe of like a noir restaurant. And it fades away to just a recording of sounds of a restaurant, right? yeah. All these like small touches that aren't full on prog, shred, instruments, blah, blah, blah. And just takes the time to be intimate, takes the time to really connect with you. It's really incredible. The drums are like, done. Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like Berkeley core should be a genre.
It is a genre. It is a fucking genre. And it's terrible, mostly. So James Norell, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, dude. It's just impossible.
I think it's James Norell. By the way, I think Sam Harchick, the guitar player, might be the brother of Max Harchick from Native Construct.
Ah, interesting. That makes a lot of sense.
And James Norell was also in Native Construct.
Yeah, and Norell is on The Faceless, right? He was filling in for drums.
He was.
Yeah. And you have
not anymore.
not anymore, yes. You have Jacob Omansky doing a guest spot on bass. He was from Painted in Exile.
Yep.
And Richard Blumenthal, he's a really cool character. From Blumen with an exclamation mark. He's doing piano and synths. And you have vibraphone and all sorts of guest spots. It's really fucking cool. Check out this album if you like, you know, cheesy progressive metal done right, done really well. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited. I'm so pleased that this album is actually good. I was totally prepared to be disappointed, but I wasn't.
For me, it kind of scratches that Native Construct itch.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely, you know, the comparison, but Native Construct go harder on the metal end of things.
Yeah.
And this is kind of more laid back and rocky and stuff like that. It's really good.
So I'm afraid that the next Native Construct is going to sound more like this and less heavy, but hey, you know, whatever. Yeah.
If it's good, then it's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we have two segments. I don't think we'll do both.
Mm-hmm.
We have the deep dive, and we also have a label turning 30.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to stay 30 throughout the whole year, so we can do that later.
Although we did go long, so we could do the smaller thing, the label thing, and then dedicate like the whole first half of an episode to the deep dive.
Did you get a chance to listen to all of it?
I did, but I could use another week.
Okay, sure.
Cool.
I'm not prepared for this, but hey, let's go.
This is easier. Let's spoil it. We're going to do After the Burial deep dive.
Yes, go listen to After the Burial's discography in preparation.
Yes, we're going to do it next week. I did listen to the entire discography in like a few days, which was very stressful.
Intense, yeah.
Intense, yeah. But I'll do it again so I have more formalized thoughts. And for the last segment of this episode, we'll turn to Century Media.
Mm-hmm.
Which is turning 30, and that's a big fucking deal. I don't know if it sounds like a big deal, but for a label that was founded in the 80s to stick around for this long,
that focuses on metal, that is.
And yeah, and proper metal. Jesus Christ, I hate myself. Like, I mean, you know, very, metal.
Not like
metal,
Sumerian,
right?
Records.
Not like Sumerian, yeah. No, what I meant was they were bought by Sony.
Yeah.
For $17 million. In 2015, mm-hmm. And it's not like Sony bought a safe metal label, right? They bought a metal label that has really heavy bands and really outdoor
stuff. I mean,
stuff.
Century Media is like as safe as you can get other than maybe Nuclear Blast.
Sure, safe from like a financial perspective, but what I meant was they didn't like buy a label that only releases metal bands from the last 5 years that are very popular. Oh.
Yeah, like Rise Records.
Exactly. You see what I'm saying? That's a safe bet. Like, say, what do those kids love? Just buy that. Like, this is obviously a very good business decision, but it's also cool that something so central to the metal community made it out there. So I kind of wanted to talk a bit about Century Media's roster, and how
important
they are.
It's interesting though, because over the last few years, they've lost a lot of their roster to like Season of Mist.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna finish with that. And
oh, sorry. Ask.
No, it's fine. It's fine. We can start with that. Like, is that to do with Sony? Right? Is that to do with the purchase and big distribution companies working vastly different to others?
Maybe, but also like what might be happening is that a lot of the bands that moved to Season of Mist are bands that kind of have, you know, been around for a while, and they kind of maybe want to take more ownership of their sound, and Season of Mist is a bit more independent of a label, and it's also more underground of a label, so maybe they feel kind of more comfortable there. And presumably Season of Mist is making like a really aggressive push behind the scenes to kind of grow their roster, so yeah, probably that.
I mean, Season of Mist has been growing very, very fast, and also because they're not sold to something so big like Sony, maybe it feels like closer to home, more.
They can be more agile.
Exactly. There's that San Francisco lingo. Synergy.
Don't even get me started,
agile.
Dude.
Dude, I work for a tech company. I have no, and Tel Aviv is like one of the biggest startup cities in the world. I don't have any right to be shitting on
actually,
you. So,
No. I was just going to continue with the topic. Sorry, I'm just getting ahead of myself constantly today. I was just looking at their current roster of artists, which, you know, it might be slightly out of date, but a lot of these artists are artists that I would consider kind of not necessarily. A kinder way to say it, because there's some of them are still good, but definitely not in their prime anymore.
Yeah, which is interesting because I don't have a graph of when bands left. And some of these bands are obviously left ages ago. But that's kind of what I wanted to hint at. My narrative was like, let's look at what Century Media used to do and how important they used to be by looking at some of the names that used to be on the label, and then look at what they are now and ask, where does the Sony acquisition come in? Yeah. Right? What is the influence that has on it? And obviously we're working with incomplete data because we don't know when bands left. Mm-hmm. We could look into it, but it would take us ages. So yeah. Fuck that. We will just pontificate pointlessly.
Sure.
So
I have some thoughts.
Bands that used to be on Century Media. Let's do the review first, and then we can pontificate.
Well, before that, actually, let me talk about a little. No. Because, like, ever since I've gotten into metal, and since I got into metal in Europe, like you kind of did as well. I mean, you presume the Europe scene moves over to there. Century Media and Nuclear Blast have been, like, the names in, like, Euro metal, I would
say. Definitely.
And, like, bands have, like, jumped between the two back and forth several times. But I view the two labels more or less similarly. Nuclear Blast is a bit more has-been, in my opinion. Like, they had their peak in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then now they're like, whatever. Century Media is still kind of keeping it. But, like, they've always been, to me, the label of, like, big melodeath bands, big power metal bands, like Camelot style. I don't know which one Camelot is on right now, but like that style of, you know, Nightwish Camelot type of bands, which Nightwish was on Century Media at some point.
And also, Blind Guardian also was on Century Media.
Yeah. So I feel like that's always been the impression I've had of Century Media, and anything else they've done is kind of things that I view as like, oh yeah, they do that too. But their main thing for me has always been that.
So I think what's impressive, I agree with you 100%. Like, they've always been associated with that kind of European scene. But it's interesting to see how they've tried to stay relevant. So yeah, they had Blind Guardian and Nightwish and Aerion and Avantasia and all these prog power bands. But they also had Behemoth. And they also had Celtic Frost. And they also had Gorgoroth. And they also had Tesseract. So when you look at the roster, you kind of see like the business mind trying to branch out and do other things. But still, if you look at the list, it's overwhelmingly what you said, melodeath, right?
I feel like the black metal stuff is just kind of crossover appeal from the melodeath stuff, because the black metal bands that they did have were like really big black metal bands that melodeath fans could possibly get into.
Yeah, and also two things, geographical definitions and just bleed over from this is a big label, we're a big band, we'll release on Century Media, right? That like Emperor, you know, they're looking for the biggest label around. They're not going to release on a tiny label once they are, you know, Emperor. They're this huge name. So, but it's still there's a lot of presence of that, like, melodic death metal vibe. Soilwork were famously a band. Arch Enemy are still on Century Media.
In Flames was there.
In Flames, Children of Bodom. At the Gates, all this stuff. And some of the, a lot of those bands stuck and they're still on Century Media. At the Gates and Arch Enemy, for example. So I feel like it's a really interesting roster. It's not reducible immediately to the metal death sound, although that has a huge presence. They also have a foot in progressive. They have Periphery, for example.
Which is a recent transfer because they used to be on Sumerian.
And that's what I'm saying about trying to stay relevant, right? Like a label like Century Media says, okay, we're going to release the At the Gates comeback, but we need something current. So they go for Periphery, which is arguably the biggest young metal band around.
Well, actually, apparently, looking a little bit more into it, it's one of those things where like Sumerian handles their American distribution and Century handles
they have
the
European one.
Yeah.
Well, it's still like an interesting branch out.
Yeah.
And like a name that sticks out. Intronaut is another. So yeah, that's kind of the roster. I agree with your overview. Century Media also does other things. They have, another Century, which is like an offshoot of Century Media. I don't exactly understand what the focus, like an alt rock thing.
Probably.
And
which, who owned Inside Out?
Who owned Inside Out?
That was also part of a big label.
I think it was SPV. SPV Records, also a big European label.
No, but yeah, it's Century Media owns Inside Out.
Oh, it's Century Media? Interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. And they also have Century Black, which is this thing where from the mid to late 90s, they re-released like super rare black metal albums that you couldn't really find, especially in America. You know, from Candlelight Records and all these tiny labels from the mid 80s. So that was a cool thing. So yeah, they're an interesting label. I think it's an interesting look at maybe the oldest, not them specifically, but labels in general, like the oldest business structure that underpins the musical community. It's that and the music journalism magazine.
Them owning Inside Out is also interesting because it feels like, so Inside Out was formed separately, but eventually they like, they were owned by, they first signed a distribution deal with SPV, like you said, but in 2009, SPV went bankrupt and Inside Out merged with Century Media.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Might explain some of that prog presence on the roster. Although Inside Out still operates independently, like they sign bands independently and they do their own releases and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, interesting. So that's it. I feel like I like doing these label introspectives because people don't usually think about these bodies. They just kind of accept them. And I feel like it's interesting to look at these kind of business units that we operate under as a community. And, they're veteran by now. It's not a new thing anymore. Like 30 years is a long time.
Apparently Nuclear Blast was 30 last year.
Oh, interesting. Didn't they release a compilation?
That was a few years ago. That was like their 25th or 20th or something like that.
Right. Yep.
It's really weird. Like those two labels occupy the exact same mind space for me. And I have a hard time which bands on, like figuring out which one bands on which label sometimes because a lot of the big bands went back and forth between these labels, like multiple times sometimes. Like In Flames, for example, and Dark Tranquility ended up on Century. I don't know where In Flames is now, but like, yeah. But it definitely feels like their relevance is kind of on the decline. They've like, I don't know, actually, thinking about it right now, like what do you think is like the big things in metal right now? I feel like Sumerian keeps shrinking and growing and shrinking back. Like I mean they acquired the Dillinger Escape Plan, but Dillinger finished. They seem to have gotten Between the Buried and Me now.
You mean what are the big labels right now?
Yeah, what are the big players in the game?
I mean, I don't think you can discount these huge labels yet. They're still very much in power and they release a lot of stuff and distribute a lot of stuff.
Yeah, sure. I'm not saying there, but it's like, in terms of mind share, they're not there anymore.
Yeah. So depends which part of the community. If you go to the tech dev, which is very important, and you have Willowtip, which is a big player, Earache Records have been doing a lot of things.
Season of Mist.
Season of Mist for sure. Season of Mist, I think, is the biggest metal, the most relevant metal label right now. They just have so much and so much new things.
A lot of diversity too. Like they really branched out to like death metal varieties and black prog varieties.
And as far as like niche labels owning their own scene, you have Dark Descent, which kind of owns that grimy old school death metal revival. And then you have Inside Out. Inside Out are important. They release a lot of progressive metal stuff. They just signed Dream Theater, which is interesting.
By the way, now that you mentioned Dream Theater, Dream Theater is no longer on Roadrunner, which Roadrunner is also like, what is
Roadrunner
going on there?
Is dead. Like, is Opeth still on Roadrunner?
Nope. Machine Head is not even on Roadrunner.
Jesus. So they have what? Like, they have Marvel's
Slipknot. Slipknot, Korn.
Yeah. Code Orange.
Trivium.
Yeah. No, they're still big. but they're like a cursed name, right? Because they have
they're also less big. Metallica is not there anymore either.
Yeah. Interesting. That's an interesting, like, escape. And from, more, I don't like the genre definition, the post-progressive, you know, like Steven Wilson's latest artwork and stuff like that. And Tesseract are on there as well right now. K-Scope.
Sleep Aids.
What? Sleep Aids, yes. What Noyan calls Sleep Aids. So K-Scope is doing interesting things within that scene. Those are the big players, I think.
So I guess it would be fair to say that, like, maybe the age of the big super label is declining, and it's more specialized labels, each kind of doing their own thing.
Yeah, and that kind of makes sense with streaming, right?
Yeah, and the internet age. Yeah,
fragmentation.
Because like back in like the late 90s, early 2000s, like Nuclear Blast and Century Media were like unassailably huge, but nowadays they're just big.
Yeah, you didn't really have a choice, right? If you wanted to be distributed, you wanted to be on one of these old SPV records were also huge before they went bankrupt.
Yeah.
I remember all the old CDs that I used to listen to were SPV.
And like, it's interesting because like metal is a lot more, contemporary now. And, so that means that there's a lot more room for different types of players in the game. Like you could have your niche genre label and do totally fine thanks to internet distribution, like Blood Music.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like once the pie gets bigger, then more players can have a piece instead of it consolidating under one label. And I don't want to jump the gun. On the surface of it, that sounds like a good thing, right? More diversity, more niche places for bands to go. But is it actually a good thing? We'll only know when we do this podcast in 10 years because Tidal refuses to die. So we'll be probably doing this. And we'll look back and we can say whether it was a good thing for the scene or not. It's not obvious that fragmentation is necessarily good for bands.
I feel like maybe as the kind of more auteur thing rises, that also pushes the more mainstream things to even greater success and kind of, don't mean to sound like an elitist, but kind of dilutes the genre in a sense. And that pushes the niche stuff even more to the niche as a result. So maybe that kind of lessens the weirder stuff. So it makes it harder to find. I don't know. Like I've been seeing a lot less big name avant-garde bands these days. Like back in the day, like if you wanted to look for avant-garde metal, there was like a dozen maybe like really big names that were like really mainstays. But nowadays there's like a lot of small names and it's a lot harder to find the good stuff because it like there is no centralization anymore, right?
Yeah.
You now just have to kind of trawl through Bandcamp and hope to find something interesting. But yeah, it's interesting.
Cool. Cool people time?
Sure. Do you have anything particular that you want to talk about?
Yes, I want to talk about all the birds in the sky. So
I mean, there's a lot of crows here, some seagulls.
No, not literally the actual birds. It's a book called All the Birds in the Sky, and I picked this up because of the blurbs. The blurbs were... holy shit, like the pedigree was amazing. I don't remember who it was now. It was like Cory Doctorow and huge names, people I appreciate. So I picked it up And unbeknownst to me, it was written by Charlie Jane Anders, who is the editor-in-chief of IO9. Now, IO9 has a few things going against it in my book. One, it's part of Gawker. And fuck Gawker forever.
Now Gawker is fine because actual Gawker died and they got picked up by like a legitimate news organization. So I feel like the quality of Gawker sites has increased quite a bit.
But IO9 has been around for like a decade now or something.
Yeah.
They're old Gawker. And I don't like old Gawker, and I'm not necessarily saying that they're like tainted by association, but it's kind of iffy. And
I also saying yay Peter Thiel.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And the other thing, I also have issues with the site itself. And there's no way for me to talk about this site without sounding elitist, so I'm not even going to apologize. They just do very populist science fiction. They just have a very specific approach to science fiction, which is clickbaity and surface level that I don't like. And again, if Charlie Anders is listening for some reason, don't, by the way, you're much more important in this podcast. I understand like the pressures of clicks and budgets and blah, blah, blah. But still, the site is just at points just meh and at points just egregiously bad. But I didn't know that it was by her when I picked it up. And it's good, but I'm also very afraid. So it's good. It's very well written. It's a page turner. It's written in a very catchy way, which isn't surface level. It's really, really fun. And it has a good story. It's about two kids. One is a girl and one is a boy. And they're growing up. And the girl discovers she's a witch. And the boy has like a magic-like affinity with science. So he can build really cool gadgets that are magical, like time travel and shit like that.
And just like in some of my favorite Japanese animes.
And they become, you know, friends, but then they fall out. And she really handles that whole thing really well. And then, spoilers, in the third part of the book, which is like the middle, you jump to the future, and it's near future San Francisco. And the Silicon Valley worship is very real. So Lawrence, the man now who works for sci-fi, he's like who works with science. He's like this. She actually uses the term wonderkind, working for not Elon Musk's company. There's some other ridiculous name which is clearly Elon Musk, and he keeps talking about how they're going to save the world and it's going to be the best. And he's so cool, right? The first time you see him as an adult, he hacks this conference of a different company and offers to buy them in a really cool way. Blah 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 blah, and the other character, Patricia, she criticizes that, but from a very shallow perspective of like, I am a witch, so I'm in touch with nature. And when you say we need to go to Mars, haven't you thought about the other animals? So, like, unless at some point it takes a turn and it says, hey, Silicon Valley is a terrible place and a terrible industry. Also a good industry and a good place, but it's very complicated. And there's like issues with poverty and urbanism and them taking control of the world and blah, blah, blah. Not like in a conspiracy way, but just becoming the thing that can do no harm. Unless it
becomes too big to fail.
Too big to fail. Exactly. Unless it becomes self-aware at some point, then I'm going to have a very hard time with this book. And I really hope that it doesn't do that because the writing and the ideas are so good. Like, the magic that Patricia does is really cool. And the science stuff, like, it's obvious that she knows what she's talking about to an okay degree. Like, when she talks about AI, it doesn't cause you to roll your eyes so far into your head. You just roll your eyes. you know, stuff like that. I really want this to be good, but unless it becomes more critical, then it's going to be a huge disappointment. And I really hope that doesn't happen.
Good luck.
Another small cool people thing. I'm playing Fury.
Oh, that game is awesome.
It's so good. If you're unaware, it's a bullet hell kind of game.
F-U-R-I.
F-U-R-I, where you only fight bosses. The entire soundtrack was written by some of the best synthwave artists like Carpenter Brute and Wave Shaper and Dynatron and a bunch of other cool projects. And what I love about the game is that whenever I beat a boss, I've beaten four so far, I feel like it's because I became better at the game. I didn't exploit a bug. I didn't figure out just the rhythm, I became faster. I became better at timing. I understood mechanics and how they work. It's a really rare feeling, right? I beat this really difficult game or parts of it because I became better at it. And the design is amazing. It really makes you feel awesome and fast and powerful. It's a really good game. That's it.
It has like a really cool vibe, and like it hints at like a really interesting setting and doesn't really like go too deep into it, but it's just enough that you're like, this is really cool.
Yep.
So I have one thing, and this is not like a super niche thing either. So there's this new Netflix original anime called Devilman Crybaby, which maybe you've heard about it.
Yeah.
So this is a really interesting project because it's based on like a super old, manga from the 70s called Devilman. And this is like a really influential manga. And it has had like several adaptations throughout the years, and they've all been like various degrees of trash. Mm-hmm. And this is like a very modern, surrealistic take on it. It's directed by the guy who did the ping pong anime, which is also like really weird. Like, it's a really trippy anime about ping pong. But this one is like really weird, trippy, and it's super interesting. Like, because, I mean, Netflix has been kind of entering the anime game for a while, but this is like a big push from them to make some like a really interesting, brave work, hiring like more creative artists instead of like going with a, you know, tried and true studio. It's really interesting. And the plot is basically, you know, pretty, I mean, it's based on a manga from the 70s. So like, it's like the main character, you know, there's demons in the world hidden around, and he like acquires the power of a demon himself. So like, you know, he retains his soul, but he also struggles with whatever, right? It's like super basic on the surface level, but it goes to pretty interesting places that you wouldn't expect. Mm. It's like a really, really cool take. And like, it's very surreal, very violent, very explicit. Like, I was shocked because like, you don't see this in normal anime because it's like produced for TV and like aimed at like teenagers. But this one is like really, really messed up in terms of the stuff that happens. And it's like shocking, but in a like, not in a like shock value way. But it's kind of, you know, stays within the conventions of anime, but also really challenges the format in an interesting way, which is not what you would expect from like a Netflix made adaptation of a 70s manga, right? Yeah. So it's really weird. It's just 10 episodes. It's like, you can sit down and watch it, and it's like just worth watching alone for the visuals. But the music is great. And yeah, it's really fucking weird and really cool. So go check it out.
Yeah, that sounds super interesting.
Yep.
Cool. Thank you.
So this is Goodbye.